everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of Thursday in the Doghouse. I'm your host and resident dog trainer, Rini Premeza. If you're a first-time listener and you love dogs as much as I do, I think you'll enjoy listening to this show on a very regular basis. I like to tell people that when you do listen, you're really attending a free class in understanding canine behavior, as well as learning about their health issues and the sports activities and jobs that dogs do every day. I also want to remind everyone that if you'd like to hear a show again, or if you've missed some shows and you'd like to hear them, you can by going to my website, www.jerseydogtrainer.com. Click on the page that's marked Rini's Radio Show. You'll see a list of podcasts of most of the programs I've done since last October. I hope you enjoy all of them. My guest today is Jane Miller. Jane works in private practice in Ohio as a licensed psychotherapist and clinical social worker with a particular interest in holistic modalities of healing. She currently focuses on educating others about the legal, ethical, and practical criteria of working with psychiatric service dogs, also referred to as PSDs. Jane has written a book, Healing Companions, Ordinary Dogs and Their Extraordinary Power to Transform Lives. Jane's book tells of many heartwarming stories of how dogs can help people with a variety of emotional problems, from eating disorders and anxiety to agoraphobia, depression, and extreme stress. Jane and I will be talking a lot today about our veterans returning home from Iraq and Afghanistan and how dogs are helping them to heal from physical injuries as well as to recover from post-traumatic stress disorder. Before we talk to Jane, please let me tell you what services I offer in the South Jersey area as a professional dog trainer. Is your dog always in the doghouse? Does he greet people by jumping all over them? Does she chew your shoes and steal your undies? Guess what? Your dog needs training. Hi, I'm Rini Premeza, the Jersey Dog Trainer, and I train dogs using only positive-based methods. My services include private training right in your own home. I also offer group puppy kindergarten classes starting at 8 weeks of age and group classes for adolescent and adult dogs beginning at 5 months of age. All group classes are held at Dog Days Camp for Canines, 23 West Main Street, Marlton, New Jersey. For more information, please contact me at 609-280-9338 or on the web at www.jerseydogtrainer.com. Again, that's 609-280-9338. We're on the web at www.jerseydogtrainer.com. Good morning, Jane.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for visiting with us today in the doghouse.
Thanks for having me.
Your book details how beneficial it can be for war veterans to live with a psychiatric service dog. Can you please explain to our listeners exactly what is a psychiatric service dog?
Yes, I can. A psychiatric service dog is a dog that is trained to mitigate the effects of the individual's disability. What does that mean? The person has to be severely limited in their ability to function based on their mental illness. And this all came about in 1990 when the American Disabilities Act was enacted. And it was expanded to include those with mental illnesses. So what happened was the whole landscape changed of what was available now for people that are mentally ill. And so now we were able to have not only guide dogs and dogs that help people that are mobility impaired or hearing impaired, but to have dogs that help assist and make it possible for those with mental illnesses to be able to function and navigate through the world. Mm-hmm. So psychiatric service dogs are dogs that are specifically trained for that individual's disability. And it can really vary depending on that person's severe limitations due to their disability. So if someone is bipolar, the dog might be trained to go get the medication for them when they are entering into a manic episode. If the person has an eating disorder, the dog might be trained to prevent them from overeating and lead them away from the food. and block them from going to the refrigerator.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So, yeah, it's very specified. It's a little different than what we're seeing with guide dogs, which every dog is trained to do pretty much the same thing based on what most people that are blind need. They need their dogs to protect them from walking into the street, for example.
Right, right. This is really different. And I have to be honest with you, it's only recently that I even knew that there was such a thing as a psychiatric service dog. Somebody mentioned it to me, and she had gone and gotten a dog specifically to do that. And, you know, I mean, we all hear about guide dogs for the blind, and we hear about service dogs and assistance dogs, but I don't know how, is this something that is recent, or has this been, have dogs been doing this for many, many years?
Well, like I said, in 1990, that was when it, the ADA changed to allow those with severe mental illnesses to be able to have service dogs.
Mm-hmm.
But it took a while, and to be honest, invisible disabilities are a little bit more difficult to acknowledge, so people weren't aware, because very few people go up to you and say, what's wrong with you? Are you blind?
Really?
I mean, that can happen.
Right.
But a lot of the folks that have psychiatric service dogs weren't noticed because they do have an invisible disability. They're not in a wheelchair. They're not blind.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're seeing more and more news surrounding this because, like you said, the veterans that are coming back from combat and, and experiencing severe post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm.
I also think the other reason it was not spoken about as frequently is, as you know, mental illness in our country is quite stigmatized.
Absolutely.
And so I think many people have really walked around with shame and feeling like it's not okay to educate others about their disabilities. And one of the miraculous things about this whole field is that my clients, because they're going out in public now, feel like they are the educators of others to enhance people's knowledge about the stigmas and let people know, I am mentally ill, but look at me, I'm functioning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really helps people to see that their image of someone that's mentally ill is not accurate.
Really, this is great. So, can you educate us a little bit about what is post-traumatic stress disorder? What are the most common signs and symptoms of it?
Well, we're seeing a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder from those that come back from combat. But before that, as a psychotherapist, I saw a great deal of post-traumatic stress disorder with my clientele because I think it's 1 in 4 women is molested and it's incest, and 1 in 7 boys. So sexual abuse, emotional abuse, physical abuse from childhood can also cause the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder. How does this affect somebody that has been traumatized? Well, in many ways, some of which are they have difficulty falling or staying asleep. They can be irritable or outbursts of anger, difficulty concentrating, and what we call hypervigilance. And I'll give you an example of hypervigilance. Hypervigilance is when you're almost to the fact point of being paranoid and you're constantly feeling a presence of something near you. And most often, especially with the veterans coming back, they experience this when they're in crowds of people and they feel suffocated. And what we train the dogs to do then is to what we call watch my back. And what that means is the dog goes behind the handler and stands there and blocks people from getting too close to that person. We also see people that come back with PTSD and or have it from history. They have what we call an exaggerated startle response.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's really severe, we have something called dissociation, which is all of us have a level of dissociation. For example, when we're driving and we go from our house to our workplace, and we get to our workplace and we realize, I have no clue how I got from my house to my workplace.
Well, you're talking to somebody who gets that way sometimes.
Right. But now, when we're talking about someone who has PTSD, it's severe.
Mm-hmm.
And severe to the point where, like I have a client, she will park her car, and she'll say to herself, it's in the second slot, and then she'll go to do whatever she needs to do. And when she comes out, she has no clue where her car is.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a real difficulty sometimes keeping track of things.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not talking dementia here. We're talking that they dissociate. They're not present. They're not aware of what's going on. And what the dogs are trained to do, in that example, would lead her back to her car. And or the dog would, when they're, like, for example, another thing, a lot of clients dissociate when they're about to have a panic attack. And what that means is they really start to get very blurry and have no clue where they are. And their dogs are trained to nudge them and paw them and lead them out of that environment that's causing them to dissociate. So that what happens is that person starts focusing on the dog and getting a sense, oh, I'm in the grocery store. You know, so that dog pulls them back to the reality of where they are.
Right.
We also have many people with PTSD experience fears of coming into a dark house. What is going to be in that house? What's going to be in that room? That's back to the startle response and the hypervigilance. And we've trained these dogs to do what we call room checks. And these dogs will go around the room and do a room scan. And as you know, any dog that senses something is not right, something happened in that room that is different than has happened in the past, that dog will come out and let you know something's off.
Mm.
But if that dog feels like everything's normal, it will behave normally.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty phenomenal what these dogs are capable of doing and how they help people with PTSD be able to function and be able to navigate through the world and be able to be productive citizens again, because so many of the soldiers and veterans are coming back, and they, because of PTSD, become agoraphobic and don't want to leave their homes because they're terrified.
Right.
You know, if they hear a noise, they have a flashback. And these dogs are helping them to be able to go places and be able to function. So it's pretty phenomenal. One of the things that I train dogs to do is frequently people with severe post-traumatic stress disorder have nightmares. And one of the things dogs can do is not only do they wake you up, but we train the dogs to lead you out of bed into the living room, have you sit down on your couch, go retrieve the remote control, hand you the remote control, and have you turn on the TV, and they will sit beside you while you watch TV until the nightmare is no longer affecting you.
Mm.
And then they will lead you back into bed.
My goodness. This is really something else. So you not only work with the individual who has post-traumatic stress disorder, you also work directly with the dog?
Mm-hmm.
That's great, Jane.
Yes, I have a history before I became a therapist. I wanted to be Jane Goodall in fourth grade. Well, that didn't happen. But so I was very interested in animal behavior shot from childhood. And when I got to college, I did a very intensive animal behavior program. And as a matter of fact, my first animal behavior and animal ethology work was with kangaroos.
Really?
And then I changed. Then I switched to domestic animals.
Okay.
But my first study was on how kangaroos behave in captivity versus how they behave in the wild. And I will say, without saying the name of the zoo, because of my study, the caging system did get changed, which was pretty miraculous.
Good.
Yeah. So that's where my heart has always been in how can I intertwine the healing power of animals and the healing power of people. And it all kind of fell into my lap because of my dog, and that story is in the book and explains how this kind of my dog led me to doing this work. And presently, my two dogs come to work with me every day.
Mm-hmm.
And they are not service dogs. They are therapy dogs. The difference between a service dog and a therapy dog is that a service dog works for the individual that is disabled, that one person.
Mm-hmm.
Therapy dogs can be certified by a number of different organizations.
Right.
And they can go to nursing homes, schools, libraries, to therapy, to hospitals, nursing homes, all different places to visit people. So the therapy dogs work for lots of people. I mean, they're there to make it a really fun and enjoyable visit and to help that person who's coping with whatever they're dealing with be able to be distracted and diverted and have a nice time with this dog that's visiting them.
Mm-hmm.
They also can be used in occupational therapy, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
So my two dogs have really changed how therapy is in my office. Their presence, I will have clients on the floor telling me stories that are so traumatic about their incest history, but they're petting my dogs, and they have no clue they're telling you this.
Really?
And so it makes the whole process so much easier.
Wow. So your dogs must be awfully calm and very understanding of this. They have enough experience with this that they just feel comfortable doing this.
Yes.
And they're perfectly...
Well, I'll be honest, one of them is a puppy, and to be honest, she brings lust for life into the room. So when I have a client that's, like, really upset, frequently she will go over, and all my clients know all the cues. So if that client wants a hug, they just put their hand on their lap, and that's a hug. Mm-hmm. And they get a hug from my dog. So they get what they need. One dog is trained to lick them when they're crying. Both of the dogs, when you start coughing or you start sneezing, immediately come by your side, because one of the things that happens when people are sharing traumatic histories is that they stop breathing, and they frequently have a difficult time, or if they're nervous, they start coughing. That's a stress signal that people do. Mm-hmm. And dogs pick up on that. My dogs have been trained to go right over to them and start nudging them and leaning against them to help calm them down.
That's wonderful. Good for you. How wonderful you must feel every day when you come home from work, knowing how much you're accomplishing and helping people.
It's very gratifying.
I'm sure it is.
Wow, that must be so hard. You're working with people that have such, you know, really, these are severely mentally ill people. Mm-hmm. And we're not just, like I said, we're not just focusing on PTSD, although that is one area that we're seeing lots more psychiatric service dogs in the forefront. Like yesterday's New York Times had a wonderful article for the veterans with PTSD. Mm-hmm. But we are seeing folks that have severe eating disorders and severe bipolar, depression, all the medication in the world, all mm-hmm. the psychotherapy in the world, cannot do what a dog can do, which is get you out of bed in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
I know my dogs, if they need to go out and potty, you're not going to be sleeping through that. So, you know, I think that in collaboration with a therapist and with medication, it can be really a wonderful fit. And it's not for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
This is a huge commitment. And mm-hmm. it's just another option that's out there that can possibly help folks be able to function.
Right. So at what age do you start training these dogs? How long does it take? And who normally does train them?
Okay. But let me go back. I would say my clients, almost all of them have chosen not to go the route of puppies.
Mm-hmm.
I have clients that there's no way they could handle puppies. The
right.
exuberance
too much
of a
to do.
Puppy.
Too much stuff there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right.
So unlike most of what you see with the programs, and I'll get into that in a moment, my clients have chosen a route that's a little unique. Almost all of my clients and the ones that I've worked with and the people that I work with have chosen to go the route of shelter and rescue dogs.
Good for them.
Yes, so it's a win-win situation. They feel like they're saving the dog's life, and the dog is saving their life.
Isn't that interesting?
The problem with that is we always have to be aware that this is not a rehab project. We are talking about dogs that are going to be service dogs.
Right.
They need to have the potential to be able to be service dogs.
Mm-hmm.
The dog I'm training right now is a Katrina rescue. And when I first met her, I told the handler, I said, you know, if you really are committed to working with this dog, it's possible that she could end up being a really good service dog, but it's going to take a huge commitment from you.
Mm-hmm.
And she just was like, I'm going to do it. I want to do it. And so in the end, that's been therapeutic for her as well.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do is what's called owner training. So I work with my clients, and I work with them after they've gotten the dog past the basics. What does that mean? All dogs need to go through socialization classes, basic classes to learn the skills that any dog needs to know. All the dogs that I work with, I want them to have what we call the Canine Good Citizen
mm-hmm.
certification.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, after they've done all these classes and we know that they can handle the being out, you know, being capable of functioning as a pretty good service dog, we start to do what is called public access.
Right.
And every state has different laws. Some states, you cannot do public access with a service dog in training. Other states you can. If you live in a state that you can't do public access training with a service dog in training, what you do is you go to the pet stores, you go to hotels that allow pets, animals,
mm-hmm.
like where I work, my office is out of the hotel, and that sounds odd, but we practice going up and down the elevator because they allow dogs there.
Mm-hmm.
So you really try to think of all the places that where you live will allow dogs, and you start doing what we call public access. What does that mean? We train them to do things that you wouldn't even consider normally, like tuck their tail. Now, why would we teach tuck their tail? Well, when they're in a restaurant, they need to be able to not only get under the table, but they have to tuck their tail. Because if their tail is sticking out, they're not going to have a tail for very long with people, waitresses and busker people going by. So we teach the dogs to tuck their tail. We teach the dogs how to deal with all kinds of different sounds, different substrates, you know, materials on the ground. We teach them how to potty on cue, because there are going to be times when you're at an airport and you don't have a long time for that dog to be sniffing
right.
around, and that dog might not have a grassy spot to go potty.
Mm-hmm.
So we train them to be able to potty on cement,
mm-hmm.
on every different substrate. We train them to be able to handle umbrellas, noises. One of the tasks that's one of the hardest for a lot of dogs is what we call hoovering. What is hoovering? Hoovering is when you go into a movie theater and there is popcorn all over the place. Uh-huh. And you teach the dog not to touch any of that popcorn.
Right. Leave
My
it.
Dogs would have a field day in there.
Yeah.
So we really then do the public access training,
mm-hmm.
and make sure the dog can handle being out in public and behave appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to prepare them for everything, but of course, you know, there are always going to be things that come up that you're not going to be able to do until it really happens, but
right.
you hopefully have a bond and a relationship with them that helps them to know what you are needing them to do.
How long does the training take?
It can take up to 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends. I'll go back. That depends on the dog and the person, the commitment of the person and the dog.
Mm-hmm.
I've had dogs within a year or year and a half. I don't want people to think, oh, boy, my dog's not fully trained in a year. What's going on? Well, that dog started out with a lot more skills.
Mm-hmm.
So it really depends on the dog, depends on the person, depends on the trainer. So after the public access, real quick, then we teach the task training. And that's the specific things I spoke of earlier, what the dog does to mitigate the effects of your disability.
Right, right. This is excellent, excellent information. So are there specific breeds that you would say are more appropriate for this type of work, or can any dog be trained to do this?
I'm a bit unique. I really have a hard time with breed information.
Mm-hmm.
I have two Goldens myself, and they are at totally different extremes. I think people have fallen into believing, I mean, all there are breeds that have traits. Yes, we need to look at the traits, and we need to be aware, can I handle that trait? Can I handle a dog that's high energy? Can I handle a dog that's low energy? Do I want a big dog, a small dog? What do I need based on my living environment and my, where, you know, what I'm capable of doing walking-wise and exercise-wise? But I think people fall into the trap of that all Goldens, all Labs are going to be good potentials, and they're not necessarily. So most of the dogs that I've worked with are mystery mutts. And I've had some people pick a mastiff.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted a mastiff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, would you pick a mastiff if you lived in a tiny little apartment? I hope not.
No, I hope not too.
And would you pick a mastiff if you needed to take the subway every day,
mm-hmm.
and or buses? Then we have another one, which is called the mystery mutt. So people have picked all different breeds. People in my book, her dog Baron was a lab, and the reason she decided to go the route of a lab was she was really scared of the confrontation she would face when she was out in public. And she thought if she went out with her lab that people would perceive that she was blind, which is exactly what's happened, and that they wouldn't ask her as many questions.
Okay.
That's what she started out with as her first dog. That's what made her feel most comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody's different, and it's less about breed. It's more about temperament and personality.
Right.
I have just temperament tested, like, 4 or 5 different boxers.
Mm-hmm.
And
how did they make out?
Of all breeds. Yesterday, this one might end up being perfect. We have to give it a few days and see how she
right.
does. And we
right.
also, the first thing we do is get medically checked.
Right.
The advantage to rescue dogs and shelter dogs is frequently we're getting them when they're a year and a half or 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So they are at a point where when we take them to the vet, we know that their hips are okay. We know that their elbows are okay. There are no guarantees, obviously, but we have a better sense of what could happen coming down the road
right.
with a dog that's a little older and more mature.
Right.
So that can be a positive. Now, the organizations, which goes back to the veterans, the programs, those are all using puppies. And those are pretty much traditionally using, and I hate the word using, but those programs are relying on Labs and Goldens. Now, why do they do that? Well, they have found breeders that they have had really good success, so why would they make a change?
Mm-hmm.
This is working. And they're a good size, so if it's a soldier, a veteran that also has lost a limb, that can be a benefit as well. So the programs, and the two that are in my book, are Needs and Puppies Behind Bars. And they're very interesting, both of them. Both of them, the puppies are trained in the prisons.
Isn't that fascinating? I love that idea.
Yeah, it's a win-win situation.
Absolutely.
You're helping the prisoner, and the prisoner is helping a veteran, and the majority of prisoners are experiencing some level of post-traumatic stress disorder. Being in a prison is very traumatic, and so there's a real connection that can happen that's pretty phenomenal. The majority of the programs at this point are for the veterans. Why is that? Well, one reason is because the veterans, the majority of them, are coming back with the same symptomology and pretty much the same needs. They come back with the post-traumatic stress disorder, whereas my clients are having many different symptomologies. So it would be harder for a program to work with training a dog for post-traumatic stress disorder, eating disorder, bipolar, depression, because that's so specialized. But these dogs are all trained the same tasks. So the programs, and these programs are getting some of them are now getting more and more, I don't want to say funding yet, because that's in slow progression here with the Veterans Administrations, but we're seeing the government and the legislation really start to recognize the need for supporting service dogs. So that's a really positive step.
Wonderful. Jane, we have only about 3 minutes left. And in that 3 minutes, I would really want you to answer one more question, and that is, do these dogs ever suffer from stress themselves during their life because they're constantly working?
Well, let me go back and say they are not constantly working. One of the greatest aspects of this whole relationship is that the client, the handler, learns how to balance their life. That no dog is not, all dogs are dogs. That comes first and foremost. Dogs need downtime just like people do. So we give them what I call couch potato time. We give them time to meditate, time to play, time to be dogs. And that's so critical for people with mental health issues.
Certainly. Of course.
Dogs teach the clients structure and routine and help them establish a better way of balancing their own lives. Yes, these dogs can experience stress. So all my clients learn about, you don't do 6 errands in a day. Maybe you only do 2 or 3. If your dog can handle 6 errands, okay, but some dogs can't. So the first thing you have to recognize is learning how to see your dog's body language and what are the stress signals that your own dogs demonstrate. All my clients learn stress reduction techniques. And they all learn things like T-touch, canine massotherapy, Reiki, and all kinds of techniques that help them. And in the end, it's fascinating. The dogs relax better, and so do the people.
Jane, where can people pick up your book, and where can they contact you?
Okay. My website is www.healing-companions.com. That's healing-companions.com. My email is jmiller@Oberlin, O, B as in boy, ERLIN.net. That's jmiller@Oberlin.net. 1-800-457-0345. And my Twitter is @JaneMillerDogs.
You're wonderful. Thank you so much for talking with us today. It's been a fascinating topic. And I think I'm going to call you, and because I'd like to learn more about teaching a dog to tuck their tail, and I'll tell you why when we talk. But I also do work with assistance dogs who live with autistic children, so we have a little bit in common anyway. But you're
wonderful.
So far ahead of me, I'll tell you. I'm very impressed with you.
Thank you so much.
Very, very much, Jane, and I hope you have a wonderful day, and we'll be in touch.
Great. Thank you so much. Take good care.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, listeners, for tuning in today. This has certainly been an interesting half hour. I want you to tune in again next week, and I want you to tune in every week. But next week, we'll be discussing canine play behavior and how to recognize what is normal and appropriate and when you need to intervene when things get a little too hairy out there in the dog park or when you have play dates with your dogs. So I hope everybody has a great week, and I hope you'll tune in again next week. Talk to you later.